Today on Maine Calling, the lives and homes of famous Maine writers. Have you ever toured the home of a Maine literary legend? Maybe Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's childhood home in Portland, or the Sarah Orne Jewett House and Museum in South Berwick? If so, what drew you there? And did it change the way you feel about that author and his or her work? Or do you feel like an author's work stands on its own and a house is just a house? I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we talk with two English professors who are delving into these very questions as they embark on literary road trips around Maine. They're making that the focus of a new podcast. The first season of the Dead Writers podcast is underway and will air on Maine Public Radio, Sundays at 8. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling on Demand is made possible by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn how you can get involved at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. Welch & Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth, from investments to trustee services. More at welchforbes.com. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering healthcare, education, and support to island and coastal Downeys communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. How much does one's home influence their work? My guests today tackle that question and more. They are the co-hosts of the new podcast, Dead Writers, Great American Authors and Where They Lived. And they focused on Maine writers of the past. Tess Chockalockal is the creator of the podcast and also an associate professor of Africana Studies and English at Bowdoin College. And Brock Clark is an author and the Leroy Greeson Professor of English at Bowdoin College. His recent book is I, Grape, or The Case for Fiction. He is also the author of An Arsonist's Guide to the Writers' Homes in New England, a novel. We invite you to join the conversation. Have you ever visited any Maine writer's home? Was it meaningful to you? If so, why? Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Welcome back to both of you. Thank you so much for joining us today. And I just have to start, because I know there must be, with a podcast named the Dead Writers Podcast, there's got to be a good origin story to how this came about. So who wants to tell the story? Whose idea was this?
I'm going to say it's Tess's idea. And so Tess gets to go first.
It was my idea, but none of it would have been possible without Brock getting on board. And my idea was really kind of born out of my work with the Stowe House, trying to save it for a number of years at Bowdoin College. Bowdoin College bought
the
it.
The Harriet in 2000- Beecher Stowe House. Okay, go on.
Yep, that's the one in Brunswick on Federal Street. And they bought it in 2001, but they didn't have a plan for it. And one plan was actually to kind of not do anything with it, let it disintegrate. So because what the college really wanted was the parking lot. The college needed a lot of parking in the space behind it, which was a dorm. And so I got involved by happenstance when I joined the faculty at Bowdoin in 2008. And I just met all these people who were into writers' houses and people who were not as well, who didn't see the point of them, who thought they should be torn down. I won't mention any names, but one of them is present here. And so the idea was born out of that process. And then I started visiting other writers' houses to get ideas for what we could do with the Stowe House, to create a proposal and a plan and all that kind of stuff. And then when it was all over, I guess I was going through some kind of withdrawal. And I was having a conversation with Brock, and I said, maybe we should try and do something with the writers' houses. And students at that time were also giving me ideas around podcasting. Like, that was the future of storytelling. So Brock and I just started talking, and from there it grew.
So this is interesting. So Brock, you actually don't think it's worthwhile to visit writers' homes, and you're doing this podcast?
Before I start getting angry emails and texts with this, I was never in favor of tearing down the writers' homes. Although I do love the visual of like watching them disintegrate. Like that would be like I would like to see a time lapse video of just a house disintegrating. Now, so I don't. I'm not an advocate for destroying them and putting up parking lots. I've never been an advocate the way Tess is for writers' homes, and I've always been interested in why people go to the homes in the first place. Like, why aren't the books, if you love the books, then why aren't the books enough? Why do you need more than just the book? So is this kind of arguing that I think made Tess and I interested in seeing what we could make out of it? I mean, but I kicked and screamed for much of this process. I just assumed like everything else, it would just fall by the wayside. And even the pandemic didn't do it. I thought for sure the pandemic would be the death knell for this project. But I've almost immediately, when we came back after the pandemic, Tess found me at a party and said, "So are we doing this podcast?" And I was like, "Well, I guess we are. I guess we are."
Well, you know, I'm thinking about it as you talk, and I'm thinking a lot of people visit writers' graves. I mean, in a way, maybe it makes more sense to visit a home they lived in. You know, maybe there are some molecules in the air or something, than a grave. Have you thought about that? Have you talked about it? Do you talk about it on your podcast, like these reasons to visit things, Tess?
You mean reasons to visit all kinds of sites, or?
Yeah, whether it's a writer's home or a writer's grave, why do people take these pilgrimages?
Yeah, I mean, like in Europe, when people go to Père Lachaise, I think that's a destination for a lot of people, and they leave things on the grave, and it's very spontaneous. But in Europe, one thing I noticed is, you know, they put writers on a pedestal. They create the Pantheon and all these things. But in the United States, what's kind of cool is that it's just these community groups, people who are neighbors or tangentially related to the author, like the Hawthorne House, and they just spontaneously start renovating or getting together to fix up these houses. So I think it's a uniquely American activity, writers' houses. There is the Shakespeare House and Henry James's house in England, but the proliferation of writers' homes, I think it's and it's not, you know, it's not something that everybody does. So it's not like a government-sponsored whatever, like the Pantheon. It's just people, and I think it is kind of uniquely American.
Yeah, and
Yeah,
sure,
I
we
do.
just on Maine Calling last year talked about the efforts with the Sarah Orne Jouett home in Rockland. But I just want to circle back, Brock, and turn to you, and because Tess brought up the Shakespeare home, and I know there's some controversy about whether that actually was Shakespeare's birthplace, but 3 million visitors a year, there is something there, Brock.
I mean, if we're just going to be talking number, so you can, I guess if we're looking to defend things by numbers, then yeah, sure. There are people who want to go to these houses, and Shakespeare's not really a terrific point of comparison because there are also millions of people reading Shakespeare. I'd be more interested in like a mid-list writer dying in like the 1950s to see how many people are reading that person's work and then going to that person's home. I mean, this is partly what Tess and I are interested in, is the relationship between an author's readership and then an author, people who go to writers' houses because they're really interested in houses, or they're really interested in killing 2 hours on a rainy afternoon. I mean, I think the stuff is all pretty fluid. And this has been part of the fun of the podcast, is seeing what people's reasons are for having any kind of stake in these houses and a stake in the writer's work. I do want to say I got interested in this way back in 1989 when I was a college senior, and one of my professors, Liza Whelan, took us on a field trip to the Emily Dickinson house, where we went to the house, and then later on we went to her grave site. And the relationship between those two things, this house, which was a kind of ordinary 19th century house, and this really freaking weird otherworldly at night grave site, something I'll never forget. So I'm not a total hater of writers' houses, but I do like the idea of all of them should be like ghost tours. And there should be a grave site visit along with a house visit.
Well, and you know, I think a lot of people make a pilgrimage down to the Alcott home. And I can completely understand that because Little Women was written in those rooms, about those rooms. So let's talk about where you started. Tess, now that you have the idea, you talk Brock into the idea, you decide you're going to build it around road trips, I understand, to the homes. Which was first? Was it the Stowe House or someone else?
It was the Stowe House. It's closest to home. It's right up the road from Bowdoin College. So we started there. And like you said about the Alcott House, though a lot of people don't know this about the Stowe House in Brunswick, it is where she harbored a fugitive slave. And that story is pretty interesting and makes the house important. In fact, now a stop on the Underground Railroad, also known as the National Network for Freedom. So that story is pretty interesting, and we tell that story talking to the author of the new biography of the former slave who she harbored there. So the house is pretty important. So we started with the Stowe House, and from there we were just kind of driving, and it was much more random as to where we were going to go.
Okay, Luke, Brock, pick it up from there. Where'd you go next?
Well, I'm trying to think of the order of the visits are not necessarily the order of the episodes. We went to
Think it was Malay, Brock. It was
we went to
the
the Malay House right next, so in Rockland. And that was a two-part visit. We went to her house, which is actually sort of a duplex. It's a house split into two side-by-side units. And one of them is the historic home, and the other one houses a visiting artist, which I think is absolutely perfect. If all writers' houses could have working writers in them, I would be 100% in favor of this relationship. And then we also went to the hotel, the inn, where Millay conducted a famous reading when she was very, very young, the very beginning of her fame. And so that was interesting because you have this commercial enterprise, this house, this hotel, and they weren't quite open yet. Not they weren't even not quite open. They weren't open at all, but they let us walk around. And it's always fun to see a hotel off season,
Is this the
right? There's
Whitehall
just
Inn in
chairs.
Camden? That's
That's
the
right.
one.
That's right. Yeah. And they're just like chairs stacked up everywhere. And you could tell, like, they haven't yet dusted off the glasses in the bar. And I loved being there. It was agreeably spooky and wrong seeming. And that was fun to see these buildings that aren't devoted to the houses, sorry, to the writers, but still have some relationship to them, whether historical or practical or ghostly or whatever. So we went to, yeah, that's right. We went to Rockland and Camden. And then we went to just basically all around Maine, wherever we could find a dead writer's house.
From there, I think we went to Gardner, to Edwin Arlington Robinson's house in Gardner. And the funny story about that is we actually tried to look for his grave, which is supposed to be very close to his house. It's because he lived on a alleyway, and it dead ends appropriately at a graveyard. And they said that he was buried there, but we were never able to find his grave.
Oh,
Yeah.
and you know what? We have we had a caller named Paul who lost cell service, but his name was Paul, and he wanted to suggest to you all that you go to Head Tide to visit the home of Robinson, who was poet laureate and wrote the famous poem Richard Cory. So more than one home to visit. Did you visit both?
We did. I visited Head Tide on another occasion. But that house used to be owned by Colby, and then they sold it to a private family who now owns that house. And we thought of going there, but we ended up spending most of our time in Gardner since most of his poems are set there. So we kind of put Head Tide on the tide and let it kind of wash away. But we did visit his other house in Gardner, where he spent
Okay.
17 years.
Yeah. I mean, Tess is underselling us or maybe overselling us visiting it. So that whole episode, Jennifer, is just a exercise in incompetence where we went to this house, which is actually occupied by a person, but we did not contact this person before showing up. She's in the middle of a Zoom call like this. And it was like, sorry, I can't talk to you right now. The dog's barking like mad. So we walked around, but we never actually got in the house. And then we walked up the street to the cemetery where we never actually found his grave. So if listeners are really into two writers who are really frustrated, then that's the episode for them.
We are talking with the two professors who are the tag team that have produced the new podcast, Dead Writers, Great American Authors and Where They Live. They started off by focusing on this state, on Maine. We've only talked about a couple authors so far. We'll talk about more after the break. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, different than the pledge phone number, Maine Calling is 1-800-399-3566. Or you can email talk@mainepublic.org or find us on social media. We'll be right back.
Maine Calling is made possible by listener contributions, along with Eastern Basements, a division of Maine-owned Eastern Mold Remediation, offering crawl space repairs and waterproofing, easternbasements.com, and Portland Stage, featuring the Olivier Award-winning comedy, The Play That Goes Wrong, through September 9th. Tickets at portlandstage.org.
An interesting take on how we value the homes of the writers that we revere. I'm Keith Shortall, senior editor here at Maine Public, and I'm here with my colleague, Luke Merkel, taking just a few moments out of Maine Calling on this first day of our Dirigo drive to ask you to support the programs like Maine Calling that you've come to depend on. Luke, the Millay House, I think they were talking about mentioning, I did a story about the effort to kind of bring that back to life from, it was just sort of a regular house on Broadway in Rockland, and these volunteers came together and made it into this now this sort of this place where Millay's work can be celebrated. And I just noted there is something about being in the same space that you know, a remarkable writer or artist or painter sort of wrote or even just grew up and began to develop. I'm not sure what that is. There must be a German word for it, but it's just explains, I guess, why we're all so fascinated about and happily preserving these buildings. We are here, though, basically to talk about Maine Public and why you support it. The number to call, 1-800-866-1475. You can also go online to mainepublic.org.
And Keith, I think the word you might have been looking for is that when you're in these spaces, it's inspiring in a way. And all the content that Maine Public Radio produces, you know, we strive to inspire you, to entertain you, to educate you. And so just like these old houses of these great writers and poets and artists, Maine Public Radio is your source for inspiration. And we do that through because of you, because of our member support. So please call now, become a member, increase your membership donation if you're in a position to do so. The number to call is 1-800-866-1475. And, you know, Keith, it's great being with you because I know that you were instrumental in the beginning of Maine Calling over 10 years ago in telling those Maine stories. And, you know, having a program like this, you know, podcasters made by Mainers, about such an interesting historical topic, it just seems so on brand.
Yeah, we did the math. It was about 14 years ago that the program started. My colleague Jonathan Smith, who had spent some time with the Diane Rehm Show in Washington, came and was the first producer of the program, and it's grown a lot since then. Obviously, up to the point where we're doing it every day, and it's a program that you've come to depend on. You're hearing my voice right now. It means that you listen to this program and you value it. Show your support, 1-800-866-1475 or mainepublic.org.
We love to hear those phones ringing. We're coming live from Portland with our volunteers, so thank you for our volunteers. Be that next caller. Be the next one to support Maine Calling and the program you count on from Maine Public Radio. The number to call, 1-800-866-1475. You can also go to mainepublic.org and hit that red donate button. That's an easy, secure way to give and contribute to this service that you love. So please, don't wait. Call now. I want to briefly mention we have a four-county match going on right now. Two anonymous donors from the county have agreed to match any gifts made from Aroostook, Piscataquis, Penobscot, or Washington County. So an excellent opportunity. Again, 1-800-866-1475.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We're learning about a new podcast that also airs on Maine Public Radio Sundays at 8. It is called Dead Writers, and it examines the homes of famous American writers. With me, Brock Clark, an author and professor of English at Bowdoin College. His most recent book is I, Grape, or The Case for Fiction. He is co-host of the podcast Dead Writers. Also with us, Tess Chakalakal, who is creator of the Dead Writers podcast and an associate professor of Africana Studies and English at Bowdoin College. Share your comments and questions. Share your stories. Send an email to talk@mainpublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to a call. This is Hallie, who's calling from Charleston. Hi, Hallie. Go ahead.
Hi there. I wanted to talk to Brock about why people go to writers' houses. First of all, historic tourism is the number one kind of tourism, biggest one. And we go to all sorts of historic houses. We go to Washington's house. We go to the Gilded Age houses. We do all that to feel some connection with the time frame from those houses. But we go to writers' houses specifically because the writers have moved us so much. And when I moved to Maine, I went to Stephen King's house. And I wanted to go to Stephen King's house, but I made fun of the experience because all you do is go and say, hey, that's Stephen King's house. I found myself going there quite often, and I realized it was because I've known Stephen King since I was 12. And also, when you're there, you meet people who have a piece of art that means something to them that also means something to you. In the case of that house in particular, you meet people from all over the world, and it's a way of connecting with people who share something in common with you. In addition to trying to see what the place is like where these people who wrote something that's so meaningful to you lived their lives.
Hallie, thanks so much for calling in. And I want to talk about Stephen King in a minute, but Brock, do you have anything you'd like to say to Hallie?
Yeah, I mean, no wonder Stephen King's really nervous. All these people like gathering outside his house. I'm joking, Hallie, of course. No, I get it. I don't want to diminish the experience and the, you know, the sincerity of people wanting to connect further with the person who made this thing that they loved. I mean, for me, actually, it's interesting. I was just talking with members of my family about this, who are, they've done what Hallie's done. They're going to writers' homes is sort of similar to the reasons they go to, say, Washington's house, right? That it's a house associated with a person who matters, and therefore they want to see more about that person. What for me is interesting as a writer is that, I don't know, the book itself for me is enough. Like if book matters to me, I don't really want any more than the book. The book is more than enough. And often when you go to a writer's house, it's like meeting a writer. Sometimes you're like, oh, I'm really sorry I did that, because that diminishes the experience of actually reading the book. I'm speaking only for myself now, but Hallie's actually onto something that made this whole experience, the whole making of the podcast so much fun for us, is meeting the people, not just who are associated with the house, but people who live near the houses, who work near the houses. And some of our best episodes, I think, end up focusing a bunch on people who aren't necessarily employed by the house, but who live near there and have their own sense of what goes on in the house or what doesn't go on in the house. So, yeah. So Hallie and I are not totally as far off as I think it seems.
Hallie, thank you so much for calling. She did mention Stephen King's house, which is quite famous. But Tess, Stephen King is very much alive, so he doesn't qualify, right?
Correct.
Though his house is awesome. He's got bats and the wrought iron fence.
Yeah. And he also runs with his wife a great fellowship program out of that house, too. They have a foundation. So he's using the house as a way to generate more writers, more cultural activities. So it's pretty impressive what Stephen King, I think, has done with the house.
I have to ask you all, before we talk about more writers, you're both professors. You both have students that are a different generation. What do they think of this whole project? Have you gotten some interesting insight, or if not, just some fun comments about it?
Yes. I mean, we have students actually working on the podcast. Ella Jones is a current student at Bowdoin College. She's working with both Brock and I, and she's our editorial assistant. So she's really into it. And we have students who are readers on the podcast. We interview students for the podcast. And when we first came up with this idea, it was really generated by student interest. I think Brock and I have a similar style of teaching, though we teach very different subjects, I think. He teaches creative writing and I teach old American literature. We both kind of ask questions more than lecture. I think that's a good way of describing it, Brock. Mm-hmm. So I think that our students who like our classes, I guess, are into the podcast because it's us just teaching. It's just a kind of like a class, a really fun class, I think, that's being co-taught in a way. So
my students find it hilarious because I reveal myself to be a hypocrite, because for years I've been saying like, yeah, these other forms, other media, they're just fine, but really all you need is fiction, and that is fiction on the page. And now that I started doing this podcast, I've gotten a bunch of emails from former students saying, oh, this is great, but I just want to remind you of something you said back in, name the year, 2018. So that's been, I've got my comeuppance several times since then.
We're going to go to Ralph, who's calling from Belgrade. Hi, Ralph. Go ahead.
Hello. Hi. How are you?
Great.
Good. Good. A little incident that happened a few years ago. Excuse me. This has to do with, remember the Shawshank movie?
Redemption? Oh, yes.
Well, the state of Maine had a prison in Thomaston, Maine, that Stephen King had wrote about that prison for the movie. And I tried to get them to not knock the building down. This was after the movie. 2 weeks I tried, and they knocked it down. That would have been a major tourist attraction, and it's gone.
Ralph, thank you.
I love the idea of not just having writers' homes open to the public, but prisons that were the setting for any kind of institution, hospitals, prisons, the setting for novels, and have there be like exhibits. I love that idea. Ralph, I'm sorry. I'm sorry that that you were stymied in your attempt to keep that thing alive. That sounds, I would have gone.
Ralph, I appreciate your call so much. I had been in as a young reporter. I did an interview in that prison. It was truly, truly a creepy place. Thank you so much for calling in. I want to bring something up that not all of the places you visited were homes or graves. You actually visited a death scene. Tell us about that, Tess.
Yes, this is the writer James Weldon Johnson, who was killed in a train accident in 1938 in Wiscasset, Maine. And he had been visiting friends of his in Dark Harbor during the summer months, and he was driving back to New York City where he lived. And his wife, Grace, was driving the car that was crossing, as most Mainers know, that train track in Wiscasset. And it was early in the morning, a foggy day, rainy, and the train didn't see the car and hit it. Mm. And so residents Wiscasset in the past few years have decided to mark this site of this important author, who famously wrote a novel called The Autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man, as well as having done many other things. He was a diplomat and musician, by building a bench in Wiscasset to mark his life and work. And we visited the bench.
Brock, you're laughing. It sounds like a somber place, but you're giggling.
It's I have a problem. Yeah, it was one of my the best, one of my favorite episodes, in part because it's so unlikely. You have a James Weldon Johnson had no, except for visiting friends in Maine, had no connection to Maine. I mean, connections to a number of other places, including New York and including Florida, where he was born. And it was just such a random, terrible thing. And I think it's interesting in part because there were a number of people who very sincerely believe that there should be some sort of memorial to this awful thing that happened to this major American writer. And the bench is beautiful. But it's funny thinking like, well, what would be an adequate memorial? And there probably is no adequate memorial. So why not just make this beautiful bench and then call it the James Weldon Johnson bench? But it's such a hard story to get one's head around. It was hard for us to place in the context of the state and the context of his work. And this to me was part of this is why I laugh, because nothing about it seems right. Nothing about it makes sense, which I think is one of the reasons it makes for such an interesting episode.
An email here from Charles. Don't forget Celia Thaxter. Have you visited Appledore Island, where Celia Thaxter held her summer parlor sessions with well-known musicians and artists? Also, where one of her famous guests, William Mariah Hunt, committed suicide.
That would be an interesting site to visit. We didn't go there. I had a former student who went there and did some work, because she was in touch sort of with, maybe tangentially, with Harriet Beecher Stowe, and she worked a lot on gardens. And her garden in that house is supposed to be beautiful, but we didn't get out there, and that's too bad, actually. That didn't make the list. The other house that we wanted to include in our season on Maine was William Dean Howells's house in Kittery Point. But because Harvard University owns that house and they were renovating it, they wouldn't let us in. So we didn't get to go there as well, and we couldn't figure out a way to kind of make a story out of it. So indeed, there are many great American authors whose houses in Maine that we didn't get a chance to visit, but maybe in the second or third season we could revisit those. I don't know. What do you think, Brock?
Yeah, we should do a whole season on visiting the writers' homes of writers that we'd never heard of before someone had brought it to our attention. I've got a bunch of emails from people saying you should do this, you should do that, and many of those writers I've not heard of. Most of them are Maine writers, some of them are elsewhere in New England, but that would be fun.
Do you make yourself read the books before you go?
Yeah, I like the punitive sense you gave there, Jennifer.
Well, I'm guessing if you've never heard of them, finding the book may be a challenge. It's not like you can order it, go to your local bookstore and find it necessarily.
Yeah, the test is much better versed in some of these writers than I was before we started out. So this has been part of the pleasure for me, as I got to read more deeply into the work of these writers. Jewett being one of them, for instance, who I'd read only the Country of the Pointed Furs before we started on this. And that's been fun. That's been fun for me. I'm grateful for that. I mean, some of them I'd read and didn't like. I'm not going to say who. And then I would
read. Oh, come on, be fun.
No. Nice try, though. And some of them I would reread, and I would still not like them as much. But it was, you know, I always tell my fiction writing students, it's as instructive to read fiction by writers you don't like as it is to read fiction by those you do like. You learn a lot from that. So that's my line.
So you have to figure out why you don't like it.
Yeah, exactly. And you also conversely try to figure out why people do like it. And that's also interesting.
Jeff, but either way, go ahead. Sorry, Tess.
Either way, the point is that you are forced, or you're inclined, to read the book after hearing something about the house. And that's kind of a cool way to be introduced to the book too. As to go back to Brock's beef with the houses, we're still reading the books.
So I do want to talk more about Sarah Orangewett, but we do need to take a break. So what I'll do is I'll read this Facebook post, and then I'll give the phone number. Jeff on Facebook says, I'm in Maine now, but grew up in Hudson Valley area of New York. My mom took us on Halloween to see Washington Irving's grave, Sleepy Hollow Cemetery. He wrote The Headless Horseman. Actual graves or homes have some energy. So thank you for that Facebook post, Jeff. If you want to join the conversation, you can find our Facebook post from today. Or Instagram, you can call 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566, or find us at talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back.
Community support is what makes Maine Calling possible, together with the World Affairs Council of Maine, connecting Maine and the world since 1977. Upcoming events and more at wacmaine.org. And Quarry Cottages at Highland Green, committed to providing low-maintenance living and offering custom homes and quarry cottages. HighlandGreenLifestyle.com.
You're listening to listener-supported Maine Public Radio. This is the Dear Go Drive, and we are asking you to be a leader for your community by investing in great local programs like Maine Calling. And we want to make sure you know that the number to call to support Maine Public Radio is 1-800-866-1475. That is a different number from the phone number to call into Maine Calling. Again, 1-800-866-1475. 1475. My name is Luke Merkel. I'm joined by senior news editor Keith Shortle. Keith, I'm going to put you on the spot. You know, as someone who's a host and an editor, what are the criteria when you think about the kind of shows you want to choose for Maine Calling, the topics?
Yeah, I think it's always been the same thing, which is, you know, our producer Jonathan Smith has always had this philosophy, I guess, which is, you know, if you have an interesting guest, you're going to have an interesting show. And so I guess that's the criteria, you know, because it's really a conversation. And if someone's interesting, and in this case, you know, we have this like Dead Writers podcasters, which is just a really fascinating take on this idea of going to the places that the spaces where writers developed and or did their work, and kind of being at one with them, kind of connecting with them in that way. But it's just another example of something you're probably not going to hear in other places, right? And so that's what Maine Calling really was. That's what it intends to deliver every day, just like today. And so now's your chance to show support for programs like this that you've come to depend on. The number, as Luke said, is different from the call-in program. The number to show your support is 1-800-866-1475, 1-800-866-1475, or go online to mainepublic.org.
Yeah, Keith, and Maine Calling is just so wonderful because, you know, so much of our news program, it informs you, it keeps you up to date on what's going on with the facts. Maine Calling, you know, just goes deeper. Like this show, they're talking about writers. They're talking about stories from the past that may have been forgotten if it wasn't for the hard work of the people who are trying to preserve them. So here at Maine Public, we're trying to preserve Maine stories. We're trying to tell Maine stories for the next 60 years to the next generation and keep them going. And we're only able to do that with your support. So please call now, 1-800-866-1475. With Dear Go Pledge Drive, we're asking you to be a leader for your community.
And we do have kind of a really cool thing. The Fiddlehead Sea Bag, which is designed by Maine artist Casey Everett of Hearth and Harrow. You know what sea bags are. It's recycled from sails. In this case, though, ornamented with this beautiful fiddlehead design. It's a limited edition available for your donation of $42 a month or $500 a year annually. It's a great gift. Maybe you could do triple good by supporting Maine Public at that level, giving the bag to someone else, and then having that person advertise for Maine Public as they walk around to the beach, the triple threat. So 1-800-866-1475 or mainepublic.org.
Perhaps Maine Public Radio is your vacation station. You know, if you listen to Maine Public Radio while you're here in the summer, thank you. Please consider becoming a member and supporting the service that you count on each and every summer. 1-800-866-1475. Perhaps consider giving at that $42 a month level or $500 annual and take that Maine Public sea bag home as a nice memento. 1-800-866-1475 or go to mainepublic.org/donate. And thank you.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You are listening to Maine Calling, and our topic today, inside the homes of famous Maine writers from bygone times. With me, the hosts of the new podcast, Dead Writers, Great American Authors and Where They Lived. They are both with Bowdoin College. Tess Tekal-Lockel is an associate professor of Africana Studies and English, and Brock Clark, a professor of English. You can join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. If you're quick, you can send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org or post to our Facebook page or Instagram. Again, the phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Tess, I have a feeling I've been mispronouncing your name all this hour, so please say it correctly for me.
The last name is pronounced Chakalakal, but you're very close.
Chakalakal. Chakalakal. Okay. So thank you. And I apologize for that. I want to go to Mel, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Mel. Go ahead.
Hi. I wanted to bring up Mae Sarton. I don't know if anybody's aware of her. Actually, it's her house isn't there anymore. It's the foundation of her house. In York, Maine, but it's part of an artist residency now called Surf Point. One of the former residents of that artist residency has taken upon herself to create a garden, actually, out of the old rooms that were, because the foundation remains, and it's become like a part of this residency. So I think, I mean, very much in keeping, there's actually a lot. She wrote one of her novels, Something by the Sea. I'm sorry, I'm not super, super familiar with her work, but and some of her journals at that location. And her cat's buried there. She's written, you know, poetry down there, or she had written poetry down there. It's just really fascinating what's become of the location of her old house.
Wow, that seems like a great destination for you guys.
So I'm a fan of Sarton's work, and we, part of our Jewett episode, we went to University of New England's Portland's campus. There's an archive there devoted to women writers in Maine, and there's a lot on Jewett, letters, journals, artifacts, and there's a lot on Sarton also. So she was certainly on our radar. That's the next season, visiting the foundations of how New England writers. That'll be season two. And their cats, where their cats are buried.
Mel, thank you so much for calling in. We have an email here from Annie. Edith Patch was a naturalist and children's book author. There is a group restoring the Edith Patch House on College Avenue in Orono. I believe it used to be a cooperative living situation for you Maine students for a time. So that makes it pretty fun. You're nodding, Tess. Do you know about this? Or
I don't know about it, but I'm really enjoying hearing about all these sites, that there are the proliferation of them. It's really giving me a lot of hope.
I want to circle back to talking about Sarah Orne Jewett, because I do believe that her home, it's sort of like the Alcott home, is very much tied up in her work. And you know, knowing that her father was a doctor and that, you know, he saw patients in the home and that she traveled with him to visits. I'm wondering about the experience of visiting the Jewett home and museum. You want to start, Tess?
Sure. That was became our final episode, and I don't want to give too much away for those who haven't been listening to it or have been listening to it on Maine Public, because of all the houses, that is the most literary author's house that we visited, right, Brock? And everything's been preserved exactly as she left it. And she was also really into interior home design, gardening, and she lived there the longest of any of the writers' homes that we visited. And that's the one that Historic New England, I think is the name of the organization, owns the house. They've preserved it, taken meticulous care of it. It's open to the public from, I think, May to October. People have weddings there, school groups go there, and it really is a stunning house. And it's beautifully preserved. So I think when we got to that house, we had something to compare the other writers' houses to, but to learn a lot from. And one of the best parts of the house for me was her library / reading room, and where she has, you know, they've preserved all of her first editions. So this house is not just a museum, it's also a library. And though people can't read the books, they can see what she was reading. That's really nice.
And I'm wondering, I was thinking about that, Tess, were there any surprises when you were looking on her bookshelves to see what she was reading?
No, I didn't think there were any surprises in that room. I think the surprises came in her bedroom. Her bedroom was a really interesting space. It kind of looked like a man cave to me. You know, she had pictures of fish on the wall and little knickknacks that she'd collected. And we spent a lot of time in that bedroom because of just the way that it was this really private space, her own space. And we got to go in there. So there's something, I guess, at once both creepy and exciting about that for me.
Brock, you're smiling. And you know what? I can't help but think, have you thought, Brock, about what it might be like in the future if someone wanted to visit your home?
Disappointing, probably. yeah, it's interesting. What Tess is saying about the Jewett House is, it was my experience also. Although, for me, the most interesting part of it, people have this notion of a writer, they have to be holed up somewhere, right? They have to have no one can bother them. They have to live in this, be in this kind of sanctum. And she lives in this big house, but she chose to write in a hallway, like the most heavily trafficked part of the house. And she's living in a house that's kind of in the center of Berwick, and there's so much traffic going on. And I thought that was really interesting. That sort of debunks the notion that a writer has to have this sort of precious, airtight space. And the house makes that seem like a lie. And I thought that was really interesting too. I don't know about the man cave, although there were fish everywhere. That was fun. Fish on the walls. I mean, not literal fish. There are paintings of fish, but yeah, clearly an interesting human being. And we went to the Berwick Academy, where she went and she had the lifelong investment in, and talked to this great student named Willow, who was really into Jewett. And that's fun to talk to a 16-year-old who's really into Sarah Arne Jewett. I came away from this heartened by that visit. But everyone talks about how kids don't read anymore. That's not our experience at all. So
we'll go to Maggie, who's calling from York. Hi, Maggie, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for my call. When I was in the 80s, early 80s, I read The Seven Story Mountain by Thomas Merton. Changed my life. I found out that his publisher and good friend Naomi Burton Stone lived in York. So I went to visit her and her husband, Ned, who were living at the time in a big house on the ocean. She gave me many memorabilia and things about Thomas Merton, including tapes that she had with him. I also saw pictures on her wall. Her first client that she published and worked with was Ian Fleming. Naomi and I were friends. She was also an author, and she passed away in the late 90s. But she's sure somebody who should be recognized as an amazing woman. She is originally from Great Britain. Her father died on the Lusitania, moved here, as I said, great friends and publisher of Merton and also Ian Fleming.
Wonderful. Maggie, woman. Thank you so much for calling in. That's Naomi Burton Stone, publisher in York. We just have a couple minutes left. I have to ask you all, what's next? Is the podcast going to stay in Maine, or are you going to take a road trip to Key West and see the Hemingway House?
That'd be nice if we could afford it. We'd like to do a second season. There are houses in Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and New York, which we could go by, like, it would be a pretty short trip. You know, we did all of these road trips during our spring break when we weren't teaching. So distance has something to do with it. And then I love that we've done this show and we're getting suggestions from your callers for houses that we might visit too. So I'm kind of open to anything. What about you, Brock?
I very much like the Key West idea. I think we should only do houses that are on beaches, warm water beaches. I'm fully in favor of that.
Yeah, and you can, you know, go to Monterey County, California, and look into Steinbeck's home. So anyway, all sorts of great ideas for you. Thank you so much for joining us, both of you. Tess, I'm going to have you say your last name again.
It's Chikalikal.
Tess Chikalikal, Associate Professor of Africana Studies and English at Bowdoin College. She's the creator of Dead Writers, Great American Authors and Where They Lived, and the author of a biography of Charles W. Chestnut. Brock Clark hosts the Dead Writers podcast and is Professor of English at Bowdoin College. His most recent book, I, Grape, or The Case for Fiction. And don't forget, you can hear the Dead Writers podcast right here on Maine Public Radio, Sundays at 8 p.m. or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's sound engineer was Sam Tracy. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. You can visit mainecalling.org to find links to our past shows and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Tomorrow on the program, the importance of eelgrass to our marine environment. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.
Maine Calling is made possible by your support, along with Baradoff Auctions, hosting its International Fine Art Auction on Saturday, August 17th in South Portland. Learn more at baradoff.com. And Archipelago, climate resilient strategies for businesses and families on the Maine coast. Law, science, policy. Archipelago.
Dead Writers Podcast, something that I will now have to check out. One of the many things about public radio is that it how it inspires you to discover and learn new things and go chase new ideas. Hi, I'm Keith Shortall, senior editor here at Maine Public, and I'm here with my colleague Luke Merkel. We're taking just a few minutes out of the programming here today as we continue the first day of our Dear Go Drive, Luke, and we're here to ask for your support. Maybe you're moved by something you heard today or fascinated, as I was, by what you heard today on Maine Calling. Maybe it'll make you pick up a new book, or maybe just go and visit the house of an author or artist or other creator that has inspired you in the past. Public radio is engaging, inspiring, and it's community powered, community meaning you. Take the opportunity now to support this program, 1-800-866-1475, or go online at mainepublic.org.
Yeah, maybe you've been listening to Maine Public Radio and Maine Calling for a while now, and we're asking you today to call now and try listening as a member, and it's a lot more fulfilling. And a great way to do that is to become an Evergreen Friend. And the Evergreen Friend program is our monthly sustaining gift program. You choose an amount, and each and every month it comes out of your account or your credit card account. And it's really great for you because you know that every time you turn on that radio, every time you listen to Maine Calling, you have that just warm feeling that you help make it happen. And it's also great for Maine Public because we financially know that we can count on that support month in and month out as we make decisions on programming, on how to grow as an organization. So please become a member today. Consider becoming an Evergreen Friend. The number to do that, 1-800-866-1475. Maine Public Radio is where you turn to hear news from your community and hear the voices of your neighbors on programs like Maine Calling. It's radio worth listening to and worth supporting today. So please, 1-800-866-1475.
Just as an added cool thing, not that being an Evergreen Friend isn't in and of itself a very cool thing, but as an Evergreen Friend, you automatically qualify for Maine PBS Passport, which allows you to stream your favorite PBS and Maine Public Television programs whenever you want. And you can catch up on the latest episode of PBS NewsHour. Maybe you got home a little late for the actual start time. You can learn what's going on with Nature, Nova. It's just a really great sort of added gift. But the purpose, the real important part here is the support for the programming. Programming on Maine Public Radio in this case, but also television. We all do it together. So the number, 1-800-866-1475, to show that support, or go to mainepublic.org.
Yeah, life moves fast, but it seems like the news, especially the last few weeks, has moved even faster. And the way to keep up on that is programs like PBS NewsHour, Maine Public Radio's, journalists. It's just really great resource to keep you informed and keep you engaged as things change quickly. 1-800-866-1475. When you make that call, you'll join your neighbors like Susan in Porter, Carol in Wiscasset, Terrence in Bath. These are people who have called this morning to pledge their support for Maine Public Radio, the service they care deeply about. We also heard from Susan Morris, who says hello to Jennifer Rooks. So a close friend of Maine Public Radio, close friend of Jennifer, Susan Morris, thank you so much for calling today. We really count on people like Susan and each and every one of you to help keep Maine Public Radio strong, not only in the months ahead, but the years ahead. So please, again, that number, 1-800-866-1475. You can also make your secure gift at mainpublic.org.
Yeah, also thanks to Susan Lipinski of New York. New York, a lot of folks are visiting now or are summer residents of Maine Public and have come to depend on the programming just as those of us who live year-round. Thank you for showing your support. And Lucas, you mentioned, you know, we talk about this sometimes about how important it's more than ever to vet the sources of news that you use. You know, there's a lot of information coming at you on social media, and you really don't know the true source of it and what its intent is. Maine Public has, and NPR and Maine Public Radio have always been about being reliable and unbiased and balanced and fair and thorough. And that's the kind of programming you know you're going to get when you tune to this station, 1-800-866-1475.